The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
And welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week, a few of our favourite writers read out their pieces for you. This week, Kate Andrews has penned the cover piece and talks about how Biden can heal America's divide. Here she is.
Having won more votes than any presidential candidate in American history, Joe Biden might have hoped for a triumphant entry into Washington. Instead, he traveled to the inauguration in a private plane to deliver his speech to more members of the National Guard than guests. A combination of the pandemic and security fears ruined normal proceedings. The event had become a target, crowds too great a risk. The emptiness embodies the problem Biden needs to overcome, not just the spats between left and right-wing politicians, but the unraveling of trust in American politics. His challenge goes beyond governing. It is the question of how to unite the country, or at least how to repair the social fabric, so that the scenes of the past few months are remembered as a freak incident in U.S. history, rather than the start of a new, dangerous era. The new president seems to understand the weight of this task, making unity the main focus of his inauguration speech. "My whole soul is in this," Biden said, "bringing America together, uniting our people, uniting our nation." Yet if you were to handpick the political hero America needs in these fragile times, the gaffe-prone 78-year-old wouldn't seem the obvious first choice. Much of Biden's political past is defined by failure and rejection. After his surprise Senate victory in 1972, when, age 29, he beat establishment Republican J.K. LeBoggs for the seat in Delaware, he had not one but two failed bids for the presidency. Even Barack Obama, whom he served as vice president for 8 years, made it pretty clear he wanted Hillary Clinton to succeed him in 2016. Former Senator Ted Kaufman once said that his friend Biden was the unluckiest and luckiest person he knew, the former referring not just to political but personal tragedies, including the loss of Biden's first wife and his daughter in a car accident. The latter, a reference to having things happen to him that are just absolutely incredible. The same paradox might sum up Biden's position at the start of 2021. He has become president when more than 3,000 Americans a day are dying of COVID. Last week, the FBI circulated a bulletin identifying partisan political grievances as the greatest domestic terrorism threat. It's hard to think of a recent time when things have looked bleaker. Amid turmoil, there is hope, however. American pharma has produced two COVID vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, and the U.S. ranks in the top five countries for the rate at which it's vaccinating. The pending approval of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine may be a game changer. It only requires one dose and can be stored at fridge temperatures. Healthcare workers will be able to go door to door in rural America, inoculating the most vulnerable. The death toll may soon start plummeting while Biden oversees one of the fastest economic recoveries in history. Should this happen, what would Biden do? Wield his power in Congress to hammer home a Democratic counter-revolution or to extend the hand of friendship across the political aisle? His first major piece of legislation, the $1.9 trillion COVID stimulus package, suggests he's going to try for consensus. It's a mixed bag of bipartisan measures with another round of stimulus payments, which will have support from a number of Republican representatives. There are also some trademark left-wing policies, including a $15 per hour federal minimum wage. At a time of huge unemployment, Republicans will struggle to swallow an American rescue plan that they believe will further hinder job growth. Biden insisted he'll work with the GOP to deliver a bill with Republican support. There are early indications that this is a genuine offer. In his inauguration speech, he reasserted that he would be a president for all Americans, taking into account the concerns of people who did not vote for him. His priorities for jobs and the administration are also telling. He was considering appointing Democrat Senator Chris Coons as Secretary of State, but he's left his confidant in the Senate to act as the whisperer to the GOP. Coons has good relationships across the aisle, referring to his colleagues as family. "We need a Republican Party," Biden said after the Capitol riot. "We need an opposition that is principled and strong." But some Democrats have other ideas. Behind the scenes, there is talk of pulling levers through the Senate Budget Committee, chaired by the divisive Bernie Sanders, to ram through left-wing legislation on a simple majority vote. Biden knows from his time as vice president just how damaging partisan divisions can be. Obama, for all his talk of unity, rushed through his signature piece of legislation, the Affordable Care Act, to avoid having to compromise, which he would have had to do when Massachusetts elected a Republican in the late Ted Kennedy's seat in 2010. This partisanship ruined any working relationship with the Republican Party. It was Biden who, in the years to come, would be sent in to resolve disputes. The result was gridlock when Republicans gained control of the House of Representatives in the midterm elections, just months before the bill was signed into law. Now, after the Democrats' victory in Georgia for both Senate seats, many in the party want to use their control of Congress to maximum effect and follow up a defeat of Trump with a purge of his supporters. Debbie Stabenow, a Democrat senator from Michigan, recently offered her own definition of how to unify America. To have real healing, she said, you have to have accountability and justice. It sounded a lot like retribution, under the guise of impartiality. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has also pointed the finger at Republican representatives who she believes instigated the attack on the Capitol. She brought forward impeachment proceedings against Donald Trump immediately. Biden, however, has not followed suit. He reserves his judgment for the chaos at Capitol Hill for the small number of extremists dedicated to lawlessness, and for Trump himself. He has encouraged the Senate to focus their minds on the other urgent business of this nation. His response is more measured, aware of the grave seriousness of what took place, but also how much worse the situation could become if that healing is not allowed to begin. There's no guarantee Biden will continue to hover above the political fray, or that he will take a more conciliatory path and try to win over the millions of voters who were told, and still believe, that the election was stolen, that the system doesn't work. To do that would require some recognition of what Trump broadly got right. Perhaps this isn't as difficult as it sounds. Biden has already framed his stimulus package as an extension of Trump's last such bill. He does not seem intent on wiping out centerpieces of Trump's legislative legacy. He wants to keep tax breaks for lower and middle income families. Criminal justice reform will stay. Trump's trademark foreign policy also looks safe, a more aggressive stance on China. Biden isn't making any immediate moves to roll back tariffs, and the return of Kurt Campbell, who served in the Obama administration, as Asia czar makes it unlikely that Trump's tougher position will vanish. Biden's choice for Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, agrees with the Trump administration's classification of the treatment of the Uyghur minority group as genocide. Yes, Biden's style is bound to involve more international cooperation and less social media antagonism, but the COVID crisis has raised alarm about China's growing influence, and Biden is not going to ignore that simply to disassociate from Trump. Still, America is set for a helping of left-wing policy over the next few years, though Biden insists his center-leftism will define the party, not the progressive sect. Perhaps this is the most persuasive reason for Biden to seek a unifying path, his sense of self-preservation. Gone are the days of Democratic supermajorities. The Senate is split 50-50, and the party's lead in the House is dwindling. It's as close as American politics gets to a hung parliament. Having allies in the GOP will help him get his big-ticket items through. He may well find more than a few shell-shock Republicans who are now willing to seek common ground. The refusal of Democrats and Republicans to cooperate with one another, said Biden after his election victory, isn't some mysterious force beyond our control. It's a decision, a choice we make. The most powerful break from Trumpism and the woke wing of his own party would be to end the hyper-partisan polarization and tribal warfare that has blighted Washington for years. For a lifelong moderate and pragmatist like Biden, there is a center ground to be found. With the country's cohesion dangling on a cliff edge and many eager to see what happens when it tips over, it cannot be found soon enough.
That was Kate Andrews, our economics correspondent and resident American. Next, Liam Kennedy has written about Biden and the darker side of Irish American history. Here he is.
My introduction to an Irish American sense of history was not in Boston or New York, but in the American Midwest. I was visiting the eccentric House on the Rock in rural Wisconsin. The receptionist told me proudly that she was Irish. My people were driven out during the famine by Cromwell and Strongbow. I admired her compositional virtuosity in bringing together the 12th century Cambro-Norman warlord Strongbow the mid-17th century hammer of the Gaels and the Scots, Oliver Cromwell, and the Irish landlord clearances of the 1840s, all in one short sentence. What's more, her declaration chimed with the self-mythologizing of Irish Americans, who trace their origins back to the Great Famine of the 1840s. It's a trope that Joe Biden, the first Irish American Catholic president since Kennedy, is happy to adopt. In September's presidential TV debate, he used his Irishness to attack Trump, claiming that he and his associates look down their nose on people like Irish Catholics and like me. Biden has deep Irish roots and an attachment to nationalist Ireland, though little knowledge, it seems, of the darker side of Irish American history. Nor is it likely that the storming of Capitol Hill by American patriots caused him to see distant parallels with the occupation of central Dublin in Easter week 1916 by Irish ultranationalists. A throwaway comment by Biden to dismiss a BBC reporter, "I am Irish," has alarmed some in the British press. Does he share a sense of historic grievance against the English? Or is that English paranoia? To understand the Irish-American mindset, it helps to examine its foundational myth. The trouble with the Great Famine as an origin tale is that, at most, 1 million Irish emigrated to North America, including Canada, between 1846 and 1850. During the following half century, several million others followed. Most were Irish Catholics, unlike pre-famine emigrants who were mainly Irish Protestants. These earlier origins explain why the majority of Americans who can claim Irish ancestry are actually of Protestant descent. The numbers self-identifying as Irish American vary wildly, depending on the question asked. The US Census Bureau reported 33 million in 2013. Other estimates are close to double this figure. But there is no doubt the politically active segments of Irish America are of Catholic background. Militant minorities within the Catholic Irish have preserved remembrances of suffering and oppression that defy time and scholarship. Even in the early 1800s, Catholic newspapers in the USA could trivialize the plight of black slaves and argue against abolition, while at the same time insisting on the incomparable suffering of the Irish. This was an early iteration of the mope syndrome, the self-image of the Catholic Irish as the most oppressed people ever. More surprisingly, some exiles from the radical United Irish movement took up the pro-slavery cause when they arrived. The 1840s revolutionary John Mitchell readily fused hatred of England and a defence of slavery. From his standpoint, we deny that it is a crime or a wrong or even a peccadillo to hold slaves, to buy slaves, to sell slaves, to keep slaves to their work by flogging or other needful coercion. Most Catholic Irish, having landed in the northern cities of the USA, fought on the Union side, though not necessarily to end slavery. The anti-draft riots, and these were really race riots in New York in 1863, saw Irish immigrants descend on black neighborhoods, burning and lynching as they pursued the business of ethnic cleansing. In recent times, the notion of the Irish as somehow the equivalent of African Americans in terms of oppression has been pressed into service in extremist Irish Americans' political circles. Appropriating the suffering of other ethnic groups may be bad history, but it finds fertile expression on social media. A more organised example was the crusade during the 1990s to place the Irish potato famine alongside the Jewish Holocaust on the school curriculum. The implication was that each might be viewed as genocide. New York and New Jersey, each with large Irish Catholic constituencies, were the first to implement this comparison. Anglophobia and the troubles in Northern Ireland were the motivation, but there may also have been an element of ethnic competitiveness. I'm reminded of the whispered comment of an Israeli writer. This was after a dark tourism tour of trouble spots in Belfast, which was topped off by a smooth Sinn Féin presentation. Victimhood never did anyone any good. The Troubles gave rise to a resurgence of interest in Irish history and politics in the Irish diaspora. But the diaspora is a set of variegated categories, and some of the finest contributions to Irish studies have come from Irish Americans, usually but not invariably culturally Catholic. It's also true, however, that a militant minority were cheerleaders for the IRA and ultranationalism during the armed struggle. As always, England was the never-failing source of all our political evils. Some latter-day Republicans in Ireland and abroad sense a new opportunity to perpetuate old stereotypes and complete the drive for a united Ireland and the defeat of Ulster Protestants. Disagreements over Brexit and the spectre of a renewed land boundary on the island of Ireland are breathing new life into old enmities. The Ireland of John Ford's The Quiet Man, 1952, that Ireland, if it ever existed, was buried a long time ago. Still, Irish-American sentimentality, bad history, and an ignorance of modern Ireland continue to animate passionate denunciations of England in certain pubs and meeting places of the Irish diaspora. But to seek to magnify Biden's assumed Irishness into some notion of a threat to Anglo-American relations is misplaced, and, if clumsily handled, might well be self-fulfilling. There are limits to Irish nationalist soft power in a post-COVID US with its record levels of unemployment, its deep racial and political divisions, and its place in a world order where the main show in town is the duopoly of the United States and China.
That was Liam Kennedy. And finally, Jeremy Clark reads his lowlife column this week, which is a message to the log police.
Here in France, everyone is a log expert. The woodman leaves a heap at the bottom of the drive and almost everyone walking past it stops to tell you you've been conned. That's never a stare, they say. It's more like half a stare. A measure of log wood in France was set in 1793 at 1 cubic metre and is called a stare. It's about 12 wheelbarrow loads. How much did you pay for that? So you tell them and they laugh in your face at your inadmissible complacency. High-ranking log police might then select a log from your heap and weigh it in an etiolated hand and pronounce it wet or unseasoned, and further evidence you'd be taken for a royal idiot. And that's before your small, costly log pile has been examined for tree species. A predominance of pine excites them to paroxysms of derision. Oak, pine, 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 oak, pine, they go, analysing the top layer with a forefinger. What you want, they say, is ash. Ash is best, or beech. Dickheads. If you're using a wood burner and it's efficient, the difference, in my humble opinion, is not that great. The other day we ordered a stair from a woodman, recommended by an expat English friend. He dumped his load at the foot of the path climbing up to the house for payment and a drink. €70 a stair is about the average price around here. This guy wanted 90 and a whiskey, ice, no water. I made him a belter. Passed it along with the cash. Would he like to sit? Yes. He consented to perch on the arm of the sofa. Our very elderly mongrel bitch, deeply asleep on the sofa, was woken nostril first by the combination of rare and unusual scents emanating from this thick-set man of the woods in his mid-50s. He handled his heavy-bottomed whiskey glass with exaggerated delicacy that looked to me a bit like parody. But his expectant conviviality suggested also a previous acquaintance with the expat English bourgeoisie, who, for all their faults and absurdities, offer strong spirits at 10 o'clock in the morning and defer obsequiously to the opinions of a man of the forest and woods. Then Katrina came in, sat, and accepted a whiskey also. The woodman, on his way up the path, had noted with approval the stuffed boar's head wearing Ray-Bans fixed above the side door. This moved the conversation in the direction of boars and boar hunting, and it turned out that we were entertaining the president of the local boar hunt. He owns 19 hunting dogs, an arsenal of rifles and shotguns, and only yesterday had organised an 80-gun shoot followed by a wood-cutting session and booze-up. "Another whiskey, young man," we said, interested. The empty glass was smartly presented, while our old dog fastened her nose to his trousers. While I fixed the drinks, Katrina interrogated him about his sex life. He was currently living, he said, with a much younger woman, an obstreperous vegetarian. Then, looking at us suspiciously, he said, "We weren't ecologists, were we?" I imagine that an ecologist in his book is a shorthand term of abuse for an animal rights supporter. I put it on record that I was not an ecologist by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, had once taken part in a boar hunt in France in which the chief huntsman had one leg shorter than the other, and three dogs were gravely injured by boar's tusks during the course of the day. "Ah," said the woodman. He now fits his dogs with Kevlar protective jackets. Expensive, but he no longer has to spend half the time sewing up his injured dogs. I put the inevitable question to him: how many? The woodman cleared his throat and said that so far this year his hunt had accounted for over 500 boars. Katrina immediately capitalised on this perhaps incredible number by extracting a promise from him of a haunch of boar for one of her famous boar daubs or stews. Then I put perhaps another inevitable question. "We've had a wolf pack rumoured to be seen in the area last week." "Seen any wolves?" I said. "Wolves?" he said. "Wolves? Don't make me laugh. Wolves are all over the place in France these days, with so many young wild boar to feed on. There are so many wolves about the place, he no longer even gets excited about them." On his unsteady way out of the house, the woodman spotted on a hook near the door my old barber. And he fastened his nose on it and inhaled fanatically, much as our dog had done to his trousers. "Oh, barber," he said. "Oh, la, 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 la." So I would say to the log police, "Look, all right, we paid €20 above the usual price. But for that, we got half a boar thrown in, an open invitation to the boar hunt, and our lives are now more romantic knowing that wolves lurk in the woods. Moreover, the stair he left us was a generous one of well-seasoned oak, like cast bloody iron it is. Put a log on before you go to bed and it burns all night."
That was Jeremy Clark. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud. If you enjoy the Spectator's podcast, you might have heard that we are hiring. We're looking for one more person to be added to the broadcast team, along with myself, Cindy Yu, and my colleague, Max Jeffrey. Go to spectator.co.uk/producer to find out more and how to apply. Thanks for listening and join us again next week.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.